Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Chris Wallace, in an interview with President Trump on Fox News Sunday, pressed him on the claim that children are being taught in American schools to hate America. Wallace asked Trump for evidence. This is part of his response.
Now they want to change. 1492, Columbus discovered America. You know, we grew up, you grew up, we all did. That's what we learned. Now they want to make it the 1619 Project. Where did that come from? What does it represent? I don't even know.
It's so, slavery.
That's what they're saying, but they don't even know. They just want to make a change.
The exchange illustrates the divide among Americans and how they understand the history of American slavery, racism, and injustice. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is associate professor of history at Ohio State University, where he teaches courses on the civil rights and black power movements. He hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance, a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anne. It's great to be with you.
James Lowen is a sociologist, historian, and author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, first published in 1995 with multiple additional editions. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you.
James Lowen, I mean, what do you make of the president's analysis or explanation for hating America, and that going from what kids are being taught to making it some sort of hate lesson?
I think that's a cheap shot that people have been taking at textbooks for many years. And unfortunately, the textbooks, the publishers of the textbooks are all too attuned to it. And so their textbooks are, in fact, completely innocent on this score. And that's the problem. That is to say, Trump is arguing that Columbus is portrayed badly in textbooks, but he isn't portrayed badly. He's portrayed heroically. Textbooks, some of them, actually still imply or even state that he proved that the world was round. Well, everybody knew the world was round on both sides of the ocean. You can see the roundness of the world if you live on the ocean, because a ship disappears over the horizon as first you can't see the hull, and then you can't see the sails, and finally you can't see the little flag on top. Well, that's not what would happen if the world was flat. It would get littler and littler and littler until it was a dot, and then you couldn't see the dot. Everybody understood that. So when we end up with students graduating from high school who think that Columbus was a man of science who proved the world round, we have taught them complete, like I call it BS, by which I mean bad sociology.
And then Hassan Kwame Jeffries, this leap to, if you teach students or children or adults the truth, that you're teaching hate for your country.
You know, that is, it's a sad state, but unfortunately, that is the defense that too many people will run to in order to keep the truth from being taught in the classroom. And you then have to try to debate not just the fact, not just what is true and what is fiction. You suddenly have to wade into this political debate and suddenly defend the fact that you're not actually teaching or preaching hate. It is really more politics than history that they're defending and using as a defense to continue to perpetuate these myths about America's origins, founding, and evolution.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches courses on the civil rights and black power movements. He also hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance, a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Also with us, James Lowen. He's a sociologist, historian, and author of The Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong. If you want to join the conversation this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. James, history isn't science. History, we've heard, and you know, any student of history knows, it's usually written by the victors, right?
Not always. Okay. That's an irony in American history in particular.
Okay.
Between 1890 and yesterday, or anyway, let's say between 1890 and about 2 years ago, our history of the Civil War was written by neo-Confederates. That is, it was written literally by people who were the children of Confederate officers. In many cases, they dominated the Southern Historical Association. And they made the Civil War out to be for something other than slavery. They stated that the Southern states seceded for states' rights. They did not. In fact, they seceded against states' rights, and each of them, when they left the Union, they named the states and they named the rights that really upset them. States like Ohio were making it hard to return fugitive slaves. That was the biggest single issue. Plus, there's even just freedom of speech issues. Ohio allowed abolitionist newspapers. This outraged people in Charleston, South Carolina, people in Mississippi, people in Texas. And they said so. And that's why they seceded. They had no quarrel with the federal government at that time. But today, even today, a majority of Americans, and I know because I've asked thousands of them coast to coast, the majority of Americans still think that this Confederacy was all about states' rights.
And I learned it was states' rights and economic issues. It was always sort of this vague economic issues kind of a thing, right?
Let me say, the economic issue was slaves.
Right.
That is, our investment in slaves, they were expensive. Our investment in slaves was greater than the United States' investment in all of its industries and all of its railroads combined. That's how much it was. And the new Republican Party, which was coming to power with the election of Lincoln, the new Republican Party was, of course, against slavery and eventually wanted to see it die out. They claimed no power to do anything about it in the states because of states' rights and because it's even protected in the Constitution. But they did want to eliminate its spread into the West.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, James Loewen makes the distinction here that in the post-Confederate South, they were the losers, but they still wrote the history lessons. Is that something unique when there is a civil war and things are not thoroughly resolved?
I think it depends.
Okay.
So James is absolutely right. Obviously, the South, the Confederacy, they lost the Civil War, but they wrote the history. They were able to control the history because they essentially won the aftermath, in part because the Union ceded that territory, the control, the political, cultural, and economic control of that territory to those who had actually lost the war. And so while they controlled, the society that emerged after the Civil War, that put them into positions of power and authority to write the history as they saw fit, which meant rewriting it. And you had those outside of the region, because of the common belief and shared belief in white supremacy, who totally go along with it. And so this is an instance where the people who lost the war had a chance to rewrite it, but only because they were in control in the aftermath for nearly a century afterward.
And we know what happens with vacuums.
Exactly, but a vacuum that is also, I think this is critically important. It's not just in this instance. It's not just a Southern phenomenon. It's Northern complicity. And we have to, Northern white complicity, so we have to be attuned to that as well. It's an acceptance of this history. So it's not just, some old Southern daughter of the Confederacy, who's spouting this history of the past. It's also now Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. I mean, so we have to look at it holistically to see the ways in which the nation as a whole has perpetuated these myths and misconceptions.
I mean, it's James Loewen. I mean, no wonder there's so many additions to your book. Things are constantly shifting.
Well, it's the key problem actually happened in around 1890. And the other speaker is exactly correct. Northern complicity. In 1890, we enter into what scholars call the nadir. Nadir means down, you know, the low point, mm-hmm. the nadir of race relations. And we go as a nation more racist in our thinking than at any other point. Even states as far north as North Dakota outlaw interracial marriage, for instance. And sundown towns, which of course are towns that are all white on purpose, some of them in Ohio even posted terrible signs at their edge saying, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in name of town." Mm-hmm. They spread all across the North. They're not even a Southern phenomenon. They're a Northern phenomenon. So we Northerners let the South tell the story of the Civil War because we didn't have clean hands. We too were joining in to white supremacy. So that's what happened. And it hasn't been that the facts have changed or that we've noticed new facts. We actually got the history of the Civil War correct at the time and for several years thereafter. And we are now, just now, beginning to return to the primary facts. We are now, just now, beginning to understand that, yes, slavery was the cause of the Southern withdrawal, and it was, in fact, treason on behalf of slavery, and so we need to do something with these Confederate statues rather than continue to put them in spaces where we worship them.
But those statues didn't emerge until much later.
That's right. They emerged exactly what I'm talking about, between 1890 and 1940.
Okay,
that's
yeah.
when most of them emerged. Mm-hmm. And then there was another little blob of statues in response to the Civil Rights Movement. So between 1954 and 1970, that's when Stone Mountain, Georgia, got finished, for instance.
Which was where they carved the faces of Confederate
yes.
leaders.
Yes, of Jefferson Davis, Stonewall Jackson, and Robert E. Lee. Maybe the largest monument in the world. It's certainly the largest monument in the United States. And we're having a little trouble figuring out how to take that one down. I saw one interesting proposal, which was to put a huge rubber helium balloon in front of it with something interesting on it, looking right at them. We'll see what they come up with.
But when it comes to other monuments, it isn't so easy, Hassan Kwame Jeffries. When you talk about hard history, when we talk about, you know, hard history, one of the things that comes to my mind, one word, is complicated. History's complicated, and we have this urge to want to simplify it. Why?
Well, history is complicated, but part of the urge to simplify is to simplify that which makes us most uncomfortable. So it's not just that we can't figure out sort of what happened and have disagreements over that. We do that all the time. It's that which makes us most uncomfortable, not only about the past, but also about the present and who we are as individuals and as a people, as a nation, that then leads us to sort of push that away and say, no, we don't want to deal with that. We want to deal, you know, we're more comfortable with these myths and misconceptions that make us feel better about the present. And that's what makes it so difficult. It's our purposeful refusal to confront those complicated issues of the past because of what they tell us, less about the past, but more about who we are today and the present.
James Lowen, in your work, what did you learn about what Black children were being taught post-Civil War and, up until today?
Well, right after the Civil War, as I mentioned before, everybody was learning pretty good history. I mean, we can think of, for example, Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural, which, of course, was way late in the Civil War, wasn't even after the Civil War, though. And at a certain point, he says, I'm going to slightly misquote him to eliminate a pronoun. He says, all knew that slavery was somehow the cause of this great conflict. Everybody did know it then. And then he goes on to say a couple of astoundingly deep things about slavery and its impact on America and its relationship to the Civil War. Well, everybody read that speech at the time. We all knew, and nobody argued that slavery was not the conflict. But then, as I said, after 1890, well, it turns out that Black folks, too, have been misled. I have taught, for example, a overwhelmingly Black huge audience, maybe 450 teachers in the Memphis public schools. And I ask them this question. I do this referendum. I say, why did the South secede? And I give four answers, because, or I generate them from the audience. They all reach the same four answers. Mm-hmm. Slavery, states' rights, the election of Lincoln, and tariffs and taxes, or issues over tariffs and taxes. That's maybe related to what you had said about economics.
Yeah.
Well, and so what happened with this Black audience was exactly the same percentages as happened with the white audience that I gave it to, that I gave this quiz to in St. Cloud, Minnesota, which is up by north of the Twin Cities. I gave the same thing to the public school teachers in the South Cleveland suburbs in Ohio. I've given it coast to coast. And until about 3 years ago, always states' rights won 60 to 65% of the vote. And they did among these Black teachers. So teachers across the country, as recently as 3 years ago, were teaching, most of them, that the South seceded for states' rights. And it's kind of a noble cause against the behemoth of the federal government. So that means 30, 40 years from now, we're still going to be having people running the country who were miseducated in 2010, in 2015.
Right.
Now, I have to say, just in the last 3 years, the truth, which was always available. I published a reader. It's called the Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. And for the first time in book form, there's all the statements that the Southern states made about why they were seceding. And they all relate to slavery. So now there's really no excuse for teaching or believing anything else.
We are talking about history. What the history of racism and slavery in the United States means to us, and why it's important that we learn it. And now we're talking, we've been talking about why haven't we learned it properly. My guests are James Loewen. He's author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. He's also professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, professor of African American history at Ohio State. He also hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance. That's a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7. NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Black Lives Matter movement has spurred much of the country to take a closer look at America's legacy of racism and slavery and injustice, and how the history of all of that has been taught in our schools. Still with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State. He also hosts the Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance, a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, James Loewen, sociologist, historian, and author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, first published in 1995. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. James, in the past, you have fought for a more honest but also a more blunt telling of history. You sued the Mississippi State Textbook Purchasing Board for rejecting a high school history textbook because it was what they considered racially inflammatory. The book included a photo of a lynching. Are there variations on the theme of truth when it comes to the issue of slavery and racism? Can it be soft-pedaled?
Can it be soft-pedaled? Sure. In fact, it has been soft-pedaled.
I mean, soft-pedaled, legitimate, I mean, and still be legitimate.
Well, it depends, I guess, on what you want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And it maybe is age related. I have to say, I would not teach the difficult stories of our past to second graders. But then on the other hand, you know, here's what happened to me in second grade. And I remember who did it. And I know the name of my second grade teacher, Miss Elliott. Miss Elliott taught me that we, by which I mean the Dutch, I'm not even Dutch, but we bought Manhattan for $24 worth of beads. And we learned that right around maybe October 14th or 12th or whenever Columbus Day was celebrated back then. Mm-hmm. We learned it right around Thanksgiving. October and November are the two best months for lying about Native Americans. Now, this is total nonsense. And it's taught coast to coast. I mean, you've heard it, have you not? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, you know better, because we know what the most famous street is in America, especially during any kind of fiscal crisis. The most famous street is, can I ask you?
Wall Street.
Wall Street. Now, why is it named Wall Street? Well, it's named Wall Street because the Dutch built a wall right across Manhattan, right there, because they were being harassed by the Native Americans who lived on the rest of Manhattan. What the Dutch did was, and I've researched this one thoroughly, for about $2,400 worth of stuff, and the stuff did not even include beads. The stuff included guns, steel knives, metal kettles, which they made all kinds of interesting things out of, plus they used them as kettles, and beautiful Hudson Bay-type blankets. For $2,400 worth of that stuff, we white people, and for that matter, I even suppose we black people or we Cambodian immigrants, we anybody but Native Americans, we bought Manhattan for $2,400 worth of that stuff from the Canarsies. Now, if you go to Manhattan today, you can get on the subway and you can go to Canarsie. When you get off, you are in Brooklyn. In fact, you are in East Brooklyn, out on Long Island, at the end of the line. That's where the Canarsies lived. Why wouldn't they sell Manhattan? It wasn't theirs. But the Dutch nevertheless bought it from them. And by doing so, they got an alliance with the native tribe. And in 1642, probably with help from the Canarsies, they destroyed the Wekaiskiks, who actually lived on Manhattan, and sent the fragments of the tribe that was left reeling into further upstate New York, Westchester County. Now, that's what really happened. But that's not a story you tell second graders. So let's lie to second graders and make this stupid story up about $24 worth of beads. Well, what does that do, though? What it does is it makes us look pretty smart and them Indians look pretty stupid, because they didn't even know the value of Manhattan. I mean, $24 won't get you a postage stamp worth of Manhattan today. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to make second graders feel superior racially, if you will, to red people. And so we think it's fine to trivialize them with the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins. That takes care of both of our towns, doesn't it? I know you're really not in Cleveland, but it's the state anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not okay to lie to kids at any age, I don't think. And I don't think we should be soft-pedaling American history
either. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Also with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries is a professor of African American History at Ohio State. We have calls to get to, but Hassan, I know you have a young child. Does it change the equation for you when it comes to teaching history?
It does, in the sense that I confess to experimenting on my children all the time.
Don't we all?
When it comes to history and teaching and learning and trying to figure out, you know, what to say and how to say it. And I actually do believe that it's never too early, if you will, but always in an age appropriate way, because our children at the youngest ages, just as James was pointing out, are being bombarded with these lies. And so we have to offer counter narratives rooted in truth. And that doesn't mean you have to get into graphic detail, but you have to prepare young kids, a young student, to learn more complex, more truthful and honest stories down the road. It's scaffolding. We build the foundation, we build the base, we build sort of this critical literacy, if you will, to shield them, to protect them from these constant myths and misconceptions that are being hurled at them. And so when they get to you know, the fourth grade, the eighth grade, high school, and college, they're ready to observe, absorb more, and richer stories, more honest and truthful stories.
Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi. It's a very interesting discussion, and especially the last point about scaffolding. If I may, I'd like to build on that. I'm from Washington, D.C., where there are not many Confederate statues, but there are lots of statues of Union generals, and they did go up more or less at the same time that the Confederate statues did. And I'll take the case of General Sherman in particular. The Sherman statue is located very close to the White House, and I think there is a reason for that. The reason is probably that the Battle of Atlanta was crucial to Abraham Lincoln's reelection in 1864. The election was in November of that year, and the taking of Atlanta was a couple of months before that, if I remember correctly. And up until that point, Lincoln, according to the Ken Burns series on the Civil War, Lincoln thought that he was going to lose the election. If there hadn't been a second term for Abraham Lincoln, the passing of the 13th Amendment doesn't seem very likely, at least not for a long time farther out. And the 13th Amendment, of course, was what led to the abolition of servitude in the United States, slavery in the United States. So that's the reason that the statue is there. In my opinion, it ought to stay there. On the other hand, for high school students, while that story needs to be told, there is also the story of Sherman's complicity in some very genocidal campaigns that took place in the heartland of America against Native Americans. And I think high school would be the appropriate age to tell those stories. There is, by the way, a very good PBS series called The Way West, which looks at how Sherman was more or less the supervisor for General Philip Sheridan. There's a statue of him, by the way, in Washington, D.C. as well.
Okay, well, I want James Lowen, kind of Terry sort of brings it around to it's complicated. Even people that we identify as with the Union, Union generals, they had complicated histories as well. Should they be on a pedestal?
Sure, I understand the point. I want to make one correction. The United States generals statues mostly went up well before the Confederate statues went up. They went up between 1869 for the most part, whereas the Confederate statues go up after 1890. And the one Confederate statue that we had in D.C. that was outdoors, which was a terrible choice, it was Pike, Albert Pike, who was probably one of the important founders of the Ku Klux Klan. Anyway, his statue incidentally got toppled 2 weeks ago, I think. But anyway, it went up in about 1915, right in the middle of this 1890 to 1940 period. But he makes a good point about most of our heroes are not perfect, and far from it. On the other hand, we didn't put Sherman on that horse because of what he supervised with regard to Native Americans. We didn't put Sheridan on that horse because of what he directly did with regard to, we put him on that horse because of what he did in the Civil War. Whereas the Confederate statues like Jefferson Davis, who just got toppled in Richmond, he was standing there precisely because he led a treasonous regime on behalf of slavery. He wasn't put up there because he was a pretty good Secretary of War or because he was a nice senator from Mississippi earlier. No. So we got to look at the prime reason why we put people up. And yes, Washington was a slaveholder. He kind of did free his slaves, kind of, on his death or anyway on his wife's death, mm-hmm. but which was unusual. But he certainly was a slaveholder. But we didn't put up statues and name towns for him and schools for him because of that. We did it because he set a good example by retiring after two terms as president, because he led the Union, the United States Army, more or less successfully, you know, for other reasons. So I think it's important that we don't worship any of these folks that we put up on statues. But it's also, we don't have to tear them all down. It's not this slippery slope. We can decide at any given moment whom we're not going to tear down.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries?
Yeah, no, I think James hit the key point. We do have to look at the origin and the motivation behind the people that we choose to commemorate, the statues that go up. That's critically important. And those distinctions between why some statues go up, Union generals, in this example, Sherman versus Confederate generals being, and those monuments going up. So that is a critical and important distinction. And it's also correct that this isn't a slippery slope. A society has the right and should sit back and reflect and engage in dialogue about the public spaces and the symbols that occupy those public spaces and decide. These things aren't permanent. They emerge out of a particular context, and reflecting the priorities of a society at a given moment in time. And those priorities do change. And so I think it is a sign of a healthy society, a sign of a healthy democracy, to sit and reflect and decide, do these symbols occupying the public space still reflect who we are and who we want to be? And in some of those instances, we will decide that no, they do not. And in that instance, in those situations, they need to come down and be replaced. In other instances, we may say, you know what? We think that this still reflects. We're still okay with this. And that's fine, too. But it needs to be part of that public discussion, and people need to be able to weigh in on it.
Before we let you go, James Lowen, I want to turn to a caller right now who's probably pretty typical of her age group. Denise in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Denise.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm a white woman, 63 years old, and listening to the portion about what the Civil War was about, I only thought it was about slavery and to abolish slavery. This is the first time that I really can remember hearing about state rights or about President Lincoln or tariffs. And I just wanted to comment that I do so agree that education has to be foremost in honoring our Black inventors and heroes and getting those out in the light that are not in the textbooks. But I just wanted to comment that, and it's been a long time since I've read a textbook, but that's just what I remember.
You know, it's interesting. I remember at some point being taught it was slavery was the cause, and then remember in the 60s a teacher correcting me saying, no, that's a myth. It really wasn't about slavery. It was about the economics thing. I mean, I can very, very much remember that, James Lowen. It's we're kind of a patchwork quilt.
Yeah. Well, the caller needs to go commend her high school history teacher, although he or she might be dead by now. I did the math, and they're at least 83 years old, probably more like 93, because that's just not what most people got. They should have. I mean, it wasn't a secret, but we taught it wrong, and we're still teaching all kinds of things wrong.
Well, and before I let you go, what about the process for textbooks in this day and age?
Well, the process is all too determined by Texas. As a lot of people know, Texas is all of the southern states and half of all of our states adopt textbooks statewide. And Texas is the largest state on the high school level that adopts statewide. California is the largest on the middle school and elementary level, but they don't adopt statewide on the high school level. Mm-hmm. So what happens in Texas determines what you folks in Columbus get to choose amongst, okay? The publishers orient their books toward Texas and places like Mississippi, where I used to live, because those are big markets. And Columbus probably adopts system-wide, that is the school district. Well, the number of students in Columbus is not ridiculously low. It's a big city, but it has nothing to do with the numbers in the whole state of Texas. Mm-hmm. So we get to choose from books that have been vetted by the Texas State Textbook Committee. And as of right now, the Texas state, Texas holds that there are three causes of the Civil War, and kind of in this order, states' rights, economics, kind of very vague, and slavery. They do allow slavery as one of the three causes. Well, of course, the economics thing is redundant to slavery, just a nicer way of putting it. And the states' rights thing, as I think I showed already, and certainly as I show in my book, is flatly wrong. That is, the United States was not engaged in things having to do with states' rights at the time. It was squashing states' rights on behalf of slavery when the southern states, including Texas, seceded. So, you know, and it makes a difference. So it makes a difference even today. Mm-hmm. We see that in an outrageous way with Dylann Roof, who there were three great events that have changed our way of thinking about the Confederacy. And his was the first, the murder of those nine church-going African-American people in Charleston by somebody who believed the Confederate myth. Well, it wasn't his fault he believed it, because he did get taught it, right? And then the second thing that happened was the Charlottesville Unite the Right riot, it turned out to be, killing one woman. And they were, again, rioting on behalf of Robert E. Lee, who was a thoroughgoing slave owner and also in sympathy with the Ku Klux Klan. And then the third event, is this terrible on-camera murder in Minneapolis that ties in the entire BLM movement and maybe even ties in sundown towns, because many sundown towns have now had their BLM demonstrations, which I think is wonderful. And sundown towns are now realizing that to have a past in which you thought it was okay to flatly keep out Black residents, that's not okay, and you need to do something to get over it.
I want to say thanks to James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We are going to continue our conversation. We're going to hear from a representative of a textbook company about what their process is in telling history to students. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how schools in years past have presented a whitewashed view of history, U.S. history, that soft-pedals the misery and injustice inflicted on people of color by slavery and racism. There's been an evolution on that front in the publishing world to give students a more progressive, a warts-and-all view of the past. Still with us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State University and host of Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance. It's a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Joining us is Lewis Sampson-Lizotte. She is Vice President for Humanities Product Development at Savas Learning Company, formerly Pearson K-12 Learning, where she currently leads the editorial and instructional design teams for social studies, world languages, and music. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Ann.
What is the process now for teaching slavery and racism in the United States? What is your equation when you approach this topic?
Well, what most publishers do, Savas included, is when we start looking at what to include in a curriculum, is that we turn and look to all state standards and district standards that we can get our hands on. And then we map and look to see what's being asked in the curricula and what's being asked to be taught. And then we work with our authors to try to fill in the blanks in those standards, because some of them haven't been updated in a while, some of them were recently updated. And we look to provide that connective tissue to create an age-appropriate, coherent story that tells a realistic, fact-based story of America.
You must have quite a library of former editions of history books there, right?
Yes, we go back several years, yes.
Yeah. James Loewen referred to, just before you came on, the Texas State Textbook Committee and how so many other states have to take what Texas will buy because of the economies of scale. Can you talk about that?
I can. I think that's, I hate to contradict him, but I think that's probably something that was true more in the past than it is today. All publishers today have the ability to develop our material digitally, and that allows us to create our content, a base content, as I said, mapped to all of the available state standards, looking for a coherent story. And then if we need to bring a program into a state like Texas, then we would customize that program for Texas. But it's not the driving force that's not the same that's going to everyone, I would say.
Are there discussions among your executives and editors where people debate whether something should be in? So even if you're doing it for Texas, is there a debate about whether it's right?
Certainly, there's always a conversation between the editors and the authors about what's the right content to be in a story. What are we telling the age-appropriate story? And in times in my career in the past, I've had conversations with our executive leaders where we haven't agreed to content that someone may be pushing us to include. We look to tell the true story.
And my other guest, Hasan Kwame Jeffries, talked about using the what we know as scaffolding and building up to the hardest truths about our history. Does that sound familiar to you and how you approach your textbooks from, K on up?
Yeah, it really does. What he said made so much sense to me. I think it's important to start telling our stories and telling people's stories, all people's stories, to children at the very youngest ages. But there is something to be said for the age-appropriate content load and the amount of graphic details that you may want to get into. And the other piece of it there is really important to teach those critical thinking skills and start that at a young age in the primary school ages, so that by the time students are hitting middle school and high school and eventually college, they're really well gripped to look at sources. We want them to be interacting with primary sources, and that's why our program provides so many of them, because that's the truth. That's the root of our history is what was written, and looking at all sides of what was written.
Hasan Kwame Jeffries, you've studied so much history. You have a PhD. I wonder, can you remember back to your, and you were thinking of the sciences when you were growing up, not history. So I'm wondering if what you learned in school made much of an impression on you. Do you remember?
I do remember.
As a child, and yeah.
As a child, no, absolutely. I do remember. And the impression that was left upon me was that I wasn't very interested in what I was learning.
Hmm.
It was very much not speaking, not only to the lived reality, my lived reality growing up in Brooklyn, New York in the 1980s at the time, but it also wasn't speaking to the community stories that I was hearing growing up, not only in a sort of Black household, but also in a Black community. I remember getting to graduate school and sitting in a seminar and sitting around a room, and many of my peers were talking about sort of what they had learned and motivated them to go to pursue a PhD in history. And they were talking about all the things that they had learned in high school and then reinforced in college. And it got to me, and I was like, I'm here because of everything I wasn't learning in high school, but then started to learn more seriously in college. So part of the impression that was left was that there are gaping holes that need to be addressed.
I'm wondering, Louis Sampson-Lizotte, about the how much is online now? You know, we talk about textbooks, and you said that some aren't updated as often as they should be. How is it even really necessary anymore to have to worry about updating when the technology has changed so much?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Ann. I mean, our company's name is Savvis Learning Company because we aren't just a textbook company. And the modern classroom teacher, you know, they're looking for a variety of materials, and we and all of my other colleagues in other publishing houses as well look to provide those. So that may be a narrative text in print or electronically, digitally. It's a lot of digital interactive content and videos. As I said, we put together collections of primary sources. We also pull together suggested lesson plans, a lot of them starting from a point of inquiry, whether or not that's a big thematic question or a specific source that students can look to relate to their everyday lives, and then sort of engage them and hook them into the study of history. It sounds like that's what Mr. Jeffries was looking for when he was in high school, and that's something that we would agree with teaching-wise, pedagogically. That's really important to connect with students, get them interested, and then to lead them from today back into the discussion of yesterday.
I understand that the killing of George Floyd made it into an upcoming edition.
That's correct. So we are in the process of updating our high school U.S. history textbook, which will release the first printing later this summer. And the killing of George Floyd happened just after we had sent files to the printer, and we made the decision to pull those files back from the printer and include that material in there. We were already planning to reprint that book after the election, so we've been holding space in that last topic to cover the election. And so now I think the editors and the authors will spend some time trying to put that material into context. Mm-hmm. It reminds me very much of what happened after 9/11 when reacting to a very large event that impacts all of America. And we're trying to, you know, the role of the text narrative is to try to provide some context, but it's just one of those tools that a teacher is going to use in their classroom to do that. So,
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, you know that you're going to be following your child. she grows up. What satisfies you at this point when it comes to how children are learning the hard lessons?
Satisfies me?
Oh, yeah, I guess gosh. What's working, unless you're thinking nothing really is.
Well, no, I try to be optimistic. and I think one of the things that is working is the greater access to primary source material. But to complement what's in textbooks, but really to expand the universe of material from which students can draw and learn from. I think that's a great asset, and I think we need to continue to develop that. I will say this, just 30 seconds real quick, that we do have to be cautious, though, about textbook customization. And while it's certainly true that I think Texas and a single state doesn't dominate anymore because we're able to customize, the fact New York Times ran a piece about this early in January of this year, I believe. And they were like, you know, there's subtle differences because of customization and how we talk about history. California may look at the Bill of Rights one way, and Texas looks at it a different way. And that can become problematic because if we don't have a shared understanding of the past, then we wind up in these political confrontations that we're having today, where we can't agree upon some fundamental aspects about what happened in the past and about what's going on today. So therefore, we have no idea how to move forward together. And so customization is great because it can speak to local needs, but we do have to be careful that we don't allow local needs to overtake what we actually need to be teaching, no matter where we are in this country.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, thanks as always for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries is professor of African American history at Ohio State. He is host of Teaching Hard History podcast for Teaching Tolerance. That's a special project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And also, Louis Sampson Lizotte leads the editorial and instructional design teams for Social Studies, World Languages, and Music for Savvis Learning Company, formerly Pearson K-12. Thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's it. Thank you for your time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.